for most of us, if not all, Dr. Collins really requires no introduction, but he's had, it seems like, a fantastic career. He's from Virginia, and he's received a PhD in physical chemistry from Yale and went to the UNC at Chapel Hill School of Medicine for his medical degree, and then pursued a residency, and then was a fellow at Yale. And then he worked at Michigan for a long time, and before moving over to the NIH, and he was the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute. And since 2009, he has been director of the National Institutes of Health. And he has won a tremendous number of awards and just a great career overall. I think the ones that are really noteworthy to us as trainees are the ones having to do with the teaching and the mentorship. And he's won countless ones of those. And, of course, we all know the Presidential Medal of Freedom as well as the National Medal of Science. He has had hundreds of peer-reviewed publications, multiple books, and has, of course, been funded very well throughout the course of his career. And it's just a special thing for me and I think a lot of trainees is that you've been a tremendous advocate for science and for research funding, and also a great advocate for current and future researchers in the country. So we appreciate that all you've done, Dr. Collins.
I appreciate that. Yeah, sure. Can I proceed?
Of course, you may.
Well, I appreciate the chance to spend a little time with all of you by telephone or computer, whatever you happen to be linked up to. I am, as Peter has just said, a huge fan of all of you and what you're doing, and the future of medical research really in many ways rests on your shoulders. But that ought not to be a sense of burden. That ought to be a sense of exhilaration and opportunity, because science is at this remarkable juncture of opportunities to discover things that even 10 years ago we might have thought impossible. I am an MD-PhD, but I didn't travel the route in a very organized way, as you might have just heard. I started out believing that my path was going to be in chemistry, and only after getting well into a graduate program in physical chemistry did I discover that biology was actually pretty interesting and made a rather strong and significant turn. I don't know if it was a left turn or a right turn, but it was a turn, and went off to medical school to try to expand horizons in a big way, and there discovered genetics as an opportunity to bring together some of the things that I liked most about the physical sciences with life science, the sort of ability to be digital about things. And now with the way things have been going over the last 30 years, that kind of emergence of biomedical research as a truly quantitative science allows it to take its rightful place alongside physics and chemistry as really rigorous sciences. But maybe of the greatest significance of all, because of the ability to understand what happens with life and how it happens and how disease occurs. So I can't be more excited about the way science is proceeding than I am right now. It is enormously exhilarating to be the director of the NIH and to see almost every day something emerging from the laboratory somewhere in this country or somewhere in the world. That is truly exciting, you know, representing a real new leap in territory that we might not have imagined we could get to. And many of you are doing that work, and I hope, even though you probably get mired in the dailiness of experiments that you're trying to do or courses that you're taking if you're not in the experimental phase, and it seems all sometimes a little exhausting, I hope you step back from that as often as you can and realize what an amazing time it is and how privileged we all are to be part of an adventure of this magnitude. That's a good part. The tough part for me, and I'm sure for all of you, is that despite those scientific opportunities, you know, this is a stressful time as far as the access to resources. And so people with great ideas are not having as easy a time as they should being able to pursue those. And we are doing everything we can to turn the corner from what has been a pretty distressing sort of 10-year slide in that support. And I think we're beginning to get some traction there, but in this town of Washington, it's a little hard to be sure of very much anything beyond sort of next week or the week after. I do think our case is very strong. We're engaged in a noble enterprise, to try to identify causes and interventions for human suffering and premature death. Not only that, we're one of the best ways of nurturing the economy, which a lot of people seem to care about. Ultimately, our case will be impossible for people to ignore, and we will get back on a stable trajectory for this kind of support. So I don't want you all to feel too discouraged about that, despite what you may be hearing from some of those in your environment who are really wringing their hands about the current resource climate. We are going to get past this. At any rate, just by way of opening remarks, I want to put a few of those things in front of you. The paradox of the best scientific opportunities ever and a particularly stressful time for resources, but my own optimistic view that we are going to figure out a way to move this forward. I spent a lot of my time on Capitol Hill. I was there today meeting with Kevin McCarthy, the new majority leader. I think the support for medical research in both houses, both parties, is actually very strong. It just means we've got to wrestle and ultimately come up with a solution for our nation's current fiscal dilemma about what we're going to do about our deficit. And we have to recognize that there's another deficit that is growing, which is an innovation deficit, and that's maybe even more important and needs the investments to get that back on track. And I think that message is getting across. So I think based on having met now with hundreds of members of Congress in the last couple of years, that this optimism that I feel that we are beginning to see a change in the direction of a positive sort is well-founded. But I will also admit that this is politics. In Washington, you can never be quite sure what's going to happen beyond that. Anyway, mostly what I hope we can talk about is you and what you're experiencing, what your dreams are, what the obstacles are, what NIH could do to be able to make your path more successful, questions you might have about career pathways, where this is all going, anything that's on your mind. I don't want this to be a lecture any more than the last few minutes have been, so I'm happy up here to basically throw this open to whatever you want to do with this time that we have together.
Okay, thank you. So I asked for people to pre-submit some questions because sometimes when you have a lot of folks who are on a call, it's difficult for people to get in vocal questions. I still would like to have a little bit of that at the end, but I did receive several really good questions, I think. So do you mind if I ask, just these are not my questions, they're from other MD PhD students who submitted them. So
sure, fire away, although you've already declared yourself as being detached from them, so hopefully you're not embarrassed by asking them.
So here we go. So one question was, so physician-scientist career paths tend to vary tremendously, as we all know. Some graduates end up going into industry, some become clinicians, some act as administrators, or some work solely in the basic scientist, as basic a basic scientist. So what would you consider to be a successful or a good outcome if you're graduating from an MD-PhD program, or if you are, let's say, a medical student trying to get into research? What do you consider as a measure of success for a graduate? Where do you like to see them go?
Great question. Well, I think we have to keep in mind that the success of medical research does not arise from one particular pathway in this complex ecosystem that determines the remarkable success story of American medical research. We want MD PhDs or MDs who are trained in research to travel down all those paths, be it in academia, be it in the private sector and industry, be it in teaching others to become researchers, be it in conducting research in a way that's not tenure track but is a critical part of a large team effort to understand something critical where MD input is essential for success, running clinical trials, all of those things. I would hope, however, that those who have invested the time, and frankly where may in some instances at least NIH has invested in you, that a career path that leads fully into private practice, as anybody else might have done who had not had that research experience, would be less likely to be the outcome, because that seems like a bit of an unfortunate waste of opportunity. So I'm hoping all of those who are listening who are interested in research will in fact see that as at least a significant part of the path that they want to travel going forward. It is an exciting way to spend your career, to be sure. And while practice can be as well, certainly if you've come this far enough to be on this call, that you have some of that sort of sense of mission towards a research career, I would want to see everybody enjoy that, be able to invest in that. Let me say one other thing about that. I do worry about situations, and I would warn you against this in the future if you're asked to take on a position where you have a lot of clinical responsibilities, but you're still supposed to be expected to do research in maybe 10% or 20% of your time. That's probably not good for you, and that's probably not good for the research that you're going to do. My sense is if you're going to be competitive in research in the current climate where things are moving very fast, and there are lots of other people out there who are doing this work as well, including a lot of PhDs, that you probably don't want to find yourself in a situation where you're spending less than half of your time on research. It'll be very hard to be competitive, to feel like you're on top of the game, to be able to chase after those ideas that compel you, because you will be so distracted by clinical responsibilities, it will be hard to achieve that. Just a little bit of advice there. Keep that in mind as you're trying to sort out your own career path forward. Research requires at least a 50% commitment. I would say if it's going to be satisfying, meaningful, productive, just everything that you dream of.
Fantastic. So I will probably ask one more question. And just because you're on a phone call, sir, and you cannot see the list of folks here, I'm going to ask one more question. And then after that, I'm going to open it up to maybe one or two people who would like to ask a question vocally, just so we have some interaction since you can't see us. So here's a question we had from somebody. I don't know who this was from. But so we have a lot of folks who are from smaller as well as larger institutions. So this question is, how do you think NIH funding should be allocated? How would you balance funding between larger institutions that might have potentially more resources versus smaller institutions that might need more investment to flourish?
Well, that's another great question. And, Peter, I know you're at the University of Mississippi, so you're probably thinking about Harvard when this question comes up or something like that. We're trying to do both, but we are a meritocracy, and basically NIH, in its decisions about how to do funding, have to figure out where is the place where our dollars are going to have the greatest impact. So certainly when it comes to research proposals, while we do have programs that specifically aim to try to spread those dollars around the country because there's a lot of talent in lots of places, when you look at the map of where the research dollars are, they tend to be in those states and those cities and those universities that have the infrastructure to support a very research-intensive environment. Just the same, I recognize that a lot of talented people who are coming along interested in research don't happen to grow up in Boston, Massachusetts, and they are in places where you would want them to have really exciting, productive research experiences that would lure them into this kind of career path and convince them that this is what they want to do. So we're very invested in making sure that universities all over the place, even those that don't happen to have the intense experience of a Harvard or a Stanford, do provide the kind of training experience for PhDs and MDs and MD PhDs that will convince them that this is the path they want to be on. So that's the balance we're always trying to achieve. Now, we do fund research in all 50 states. It does vary a bit in terms of the size of the university and the number of faculty that are devoted to full-time research. But I hope that whatever state somebody is in, there is enough of a critical mass there at the current time to find an exciting project and a mentor and an opportunity to really try your hand at this and get convinced that this is a path you want to follow.
Great. I'm going to let Steve Krasnowski, do you want to ask your questions? Go ahead and say, you know, where you're from, and then you can ask your question, Steve.
Sure. My name is Steve Krasnowski from the University of Florida's MD-PhD program, and I just had kind of a general question. Different labs obviously operate different ways, and kind of building off the previous question, do you think maybe you could elaborate on the importance of collaborations between different groups versus competition that we see in the research environment, and where do you think a healthy balance might exist between the two?
Well, that's a great question, Steve, and something that I think everybody's looking at right now, trying to figure out what's the right balance. First of all, I don't think competition is necessarily a bad thing. Competition does inspire people maybe to push a little harder, to come up with a little bit more of a creative approach. If we had no competition in biomedical research, that would not necessarily be a good thing. But frankly, hyper-competition, where the whole goal seems to be to beat the other guy into print, and therefore to get your paper submitted to a journal that has only one word in its name and that basically rushes you out there as quickly as possible. I think that's turned out to be a little bit destructive, and the worshiping of the impact factor is a part of that that I think has actually turned out to be a bit of a negative part of our environment. My sense is that we have arrived at a point in biomedical research where the really exciting science that a lot of people would like to try to do really benefits from collaboration and the opportunity to reach out and find others in your institution or oftentimes at other institutions who have complementary skills makes this go a lot faster and to be a lot more fun. I run a research lab at NIH. I have about 10 people in my group, including 3 postdocs, about to be 4, a couple of graduate students, and the others being technicians or postbacs, where we have folks who come to us in between undergraduate in either graduate school or medical school who spend a year or two in the lab. My lab is incredibly devoted to collaborative approaches. We're studying diabetes on the one hand and progeria, a very rare form of premature aging, on the other. Almost everything we're doing is connected to a collaboration. The diabetes effort in Finland and Michigan and UCLA, where we have longstanding collaborations, progeria efforts with a number of groups in Boston and at Maryland, University of Maryland. And it just makes it go faster and be a lot more fun. And I think everybody benefits from that. There's always this anxiety that if you do a collaboration, your own effort may be diluted a bit, and maybe it'll be harder for people to appreciate what your contribution was. And we have not helped that, I think, in the way in which people have been evaluated by committees who basically look at publications and say, is your name first or last? We have got to get over that. NIH is very strongly now pushing the idea that we should have a different way of viewing people's resumes, where you look at most significant publications and you find out what did that person do to contribute to that publication, and you don't just count papers and look at first and last authors, because that's just not the way science is anymore. So, Steve, I would say most of the time, if it's a debate between do you collaborate or compete, try the collaboration thing if you think there's a good complementary way in which skills are going to join up. You'll learn a lot. You'll go faster. You'll get to know people with a different perspective that enlarges your own. It's just the way science is going.
Thank you. Great.
All right, Eve, do you want to go ahead?
Sure. Dr. Collins, thank you for being with us tonight. I have been thinking about how other countries approach and support physician scientists, trainees, and in particular looking at Singapore and China that are heavily investing in residency training that offers research opportunities and are heavily recruiting even from within the U.S. So, and keeping also in mind that currently there is a lot of push by medical departments to have stronger clinical commitment at the expense of research. So how do you think all these attitudes in the U.S. and abroad would affect U.S. ability to continue to be number one in biomedical research? And given the opportunities abroad, would you think that it would be best for our trainees to consider moving overseas for training?
So, great question, Eve. Eve, where are you from?
I am from State University of New York.
Okay. I'm concerned about many of these issues, and so a year and a half ago, I asked a working group of my advisory committee, and I asked David Ginsberg, the University of Michigan, to co-chair it along with Susan Schurin of the Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, and Sherry Mills, who's part of my director's office staff and an expert on workforce. I asked them to look at where we're going in terms of the training of physician scientists in the United States. And they did a lot of data gathering to try to assess what the trends were And I must say, it was a little hard to get some of the data because even though we've been training MDs and MD-PhDs, we have not generally had permission to track them for life and find out what happened and where did they end up and are they doing research and if so, what kind of research. You would think in the era of LinkedIn and Facebook and everything else, it would not be hard to find people. But it's still a little bit harder than you might think, and not sure that we've used all the right tools that we should. So the data was a little incomplete. But I must say it was troubling to see the trends in the United States, where if you look at MDs and MD-PhDs who are becoming full-time researchers, and by our measure that means that they're listed on an NIH grant as having a major contribution to research. So we're not looking at industry, we're looking at academia. Admittedly, that's a very narrow snapshot, but it's one that sort of shows you some of the trends. It's clear that that input function to biomedical research in academia has been dropping back over the last 10 or 15 years. And that means that the average physician researcher in academia has been getting older and grayer over the course of that same timetable, and I don't think that's healthy at all. There are, of course, lots of factors, and Ginsberg and his team ran a bunch of focus groups to listen to trainees about what those were. Some of them relate to loans that add up to very large dollar figures for people who have to figure out how to pay them back and who know that research training may prolong the training period and may not put you in the most lucrative salary track. Plus, there is the issue about looking ahead and looking at other people who are trying to do medical research and struggling perhaps more than they used to find the funding. And there is, of course, the excitement about doing clinical work, which is, you know, pretty satisfying. I've done a fair amount of that myself. It's fun to take care of patients. And it's not as if research doesn't work out, you've got nothing else to do. You have a great alternative. All of those things factoring together seem to be leading to a disturbing trend where more and more of those who have the research training are choosing to follow career paths where they don't use it to a great degree or sometimes even at all. Now, as you said, Eve, that may not be the case in other parts of the world. Now, certainly, other countries that read the American playbook and are looking back over the last 20 years are trying to recreate a setting that we had in the past and which we ourselves are struggling now to maintain. And certainly places like Singapore and China, or I recently visited Brazil, and it was interesting to see what they're doing there, are very much trying to create stable pathways for physician researchers that have incentives and encourage this as something that is going to be financially secure and intellectually stimulating. My sense from the report from the Ginsberg team, and they reported just 3 weeks ago at the advisory committee to the director, and if you go to their website, just on the NIH homepage, you can read that report. It was sobering, and we need to do some additional things to try to provide those kinds of positive incentives in the U.S. so that this trend doesn't continue. Peter, I don't know if it's fair at this point to actually ask the people on the phone to react to that and if there are things that they would point to that would make a real difference here in terms of nurturing and encouraging physician scientists on a career path to continue to do meaningful research. I'd love to hear it. We could have our own little focus group right now if that would be appropriate.
Sure, yeah. If anybody would like, just go ahead and unmute your mic and go ahead and respond if anybody has anything.
Dr. Collins, hi. My name is Zachary Kiss, and I'm actually experiencing that myself a bit right now. My undergraduate degree was in theater and geography and human geography specifically, and I've been having a little bit of difficulty in the application process because I've only had a year to accumulate my laboratory experience, so I've been working pretty hard, but you know, it's. I think that a lot of the programs are expecting 2 years of experience, and I think that sometimes that that negates from some of what we can offer as other students to the process. I just completed a post-baccalaureate program, so I should say that too.
And you're applying to a MD, PhD, and MSTP program? Is that where you're running into this, oh, you need 2 years experience reaction?
I'd like to do that, but I think that for now I might do what you've done and pursue a PhD in chemistry first. But I know I am going to be applying to the MSTP programs. I just don't think that I have a great shot of getting in.
So you're arguing that we are setting way too high a bar for people to get into this pathway of being a physician scientist by expecting them somehow to have known that they wanted to do that when they were 12 years old and accumulating all the appropriate credentials.
I think that that might be part of the problem. I don't think that that's the entire problem. I think that that more importantly, that like you mentioned a little bit earlier, I think that the selection process needs a little bit more personalization in terms of the types of candidates that are being selected, and not simply ones that are being selected because of the they went to reputable institutions and they have excellent GPAs and things like that. We should be more judged based on the work that we've done in scientific research and the things that we've been able to do for our communities while still undergrads.
Yes. Point taken. I hear what you're saying, and I kind of agree with it. Other comments?
Thanks, by the way.
Yeah.
Hi, Dr. Collins. I'm kind of at the beginning of my training, so I don't really have a complete perspective on this, but as I was considering whether to pursue an MD, PhD, or a PhD program, and in my conversations with PhD students, it seems as though in the physical sciences, there's hard money, I guess, that if you want to go into research, you know that you'll be able to do that. But looking at the path ahead, if you want to do research and you get a position, you'll know you'll have the institutional support to do that. But in my conversations with physician scientists, it seems that in many cases, they don't have the institutional support. There's pressure them that if you don't raise the money on your own to support your salary, you can't pursue research or at the same level, say at 80% protected time. So there's a lot of uncertainty that even if I wanted to do research, I wouldn't be able to.
I hear you, and I think that is a serious issue, and here's where institutions, particularly universities, I think have to take a hard look at themselves in terms of what they're asking people to actually manage to do. If you really want your physician scientists to be top-notch in their field, to be recognized for their contributions, to change their understanding of biology and medicine, you can't expect them also to be in a clinic, 4 days out of five. And attending on the ward every quarter.
Other callers on the call.
Something happened there. And to spend a lot of time. Hello.
Mute there. Please.
Okay. Are we back?
Oh, I'm getting an echo, I'm afraid.
So, Pete, any suggestions?
Does everyone have their...
Hold on a sec, let me see.
All right, how about now? I just muted Vin. Sorry, Vin, but go ahead. Sorry, Dr. Collins.
Sounds better now.
Yeah.
Well, I will just finish the thread if anybody's still there. I think this is one of the dialogues now that I think we at NIH need to have with our university colleagues, which is recognizing that universities and medical centers are themselves struggling financially. the solution to that cannot be to take physician scientists and expect them to become full-time care providers. Otherwise, the idea of a research university is going to slip away. Now, there has to be another means to provide protected time for those individuals to continue to spend most of their thinking time and working time doing research and not being in the clinic or the operating room or somewhere else where it's very difficult to keep your mind on what you're trying to accomplish. But that is, I think, a conclusion that most of the deans of the AAMC would agree with, but it's not necessarily always applied in practice. All of you, as you're going to look ultimately for academic positions or industry positions or whatever it is, boy, this is something you really have to get nailed down before you agree to it. What is the time commitment that they are signing in ink that they are committed to for you in terms of protected time to do the things that you're going to need to be a successful researcher?
Thank you very much for answering that.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Collins, I just wanted to mention that we actually had Dr. David Ginsberg on our interactive session just a few weeks ago. So
did you?
You mentioned it. Yeah, I knew you were a good friend of his. So
he was the best man at my wedding, so you can't be much better friend than that.
I heard. All right, Stephanie, do you want to go ahead? Stephanie Robert? If not, I can ask her question. She actually typed it into the chat box. Oh, Stephanie, go ahead.
Hello. Oh, sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah,
we can.
Dr. Collins, thanks for spending some time with us this evening. I'm an MD-PhD student at University of Alabama, Birmingham. And I was wondering if maybe you had any advice or some words of wisdom for those of us in this type of program that may be interested in some type of surgical specialty, since it's still a not as common way of doing a career as an MD-PhD, and how successful surgeon scientists are getting funding and what maybe a good model is for a surgeon scientist, since it's a little bit different than some of the other types of specialties that you can pick.
That's another great question, Stephanie. There are certainly some very productive, impressive MD-PhDs or MD researchers whose specialties are in the area of surgery. I think probably more in some parts of surgery than others. It's obviously going to be very critical in that situation to figure out what the balance is between clinical responsibilities and research, and some might argue that in order to maintain your surgical skills, a certain commitment as far as time is going to be required, which may then be a squeeze on your research time. Myself as an internist, I think I could say that my medical skills probably can be maintained reasonably well with 20% commitment. I'm not sure if I was a general surgeon, I could say that. So there is a tension there, I think, just on the basis of the necessity of being a really good clinician for the part of your life where you're being a clinician. But putting that aside, I think there are certainly opportunities there. But frankly, the demographics would say there are far fewer successful researchers who are general surgeons than there are researchers who are hematologists or pediatricians. So one needs to sort of look at that and ask the question, why? Is that because of the environment, or is that because people who migrate into surgical specialties are by their nature more interested in doing surgery than not necessarily doing research? And I think it's probably mostly the latter, but it may be a bit of the former. I would certainly say to you, Stephanie, if that is what you feel like is your calling, that's something to pay attention to. I think all of us should really look for what is that sense of mission that begins to emerge, and consider that to be a really important part of decision making, as long as you're sure that it has been tested in the sort of reality check about is this going to be feasible. And a lot of reality checking then is to look around and say, okay, who are people who are out there that I could identify with and maybe even get to know personally, who are doing what I think I want to do, and what's that like for them? So Stephanie, I hope you've had a chance, if you're migrating in this direction of a surgical specialty and but wanting to do research, to find others who are doing that, who you would consider to have done so successfully, and to have a heart-to-heart with them about how that works and are they feeling fully, you know, realized as a consequence of the choices they've made, given that there must be some tensions involved. That, I would think, at UAB would be the kind of thing where you could find such individuals and have that conversation. Is that something you've been able to do?
I have, yeah. There's not a ton of people out there that are doing doing both well, but I have. We have a few really good role models that are part of APSA and some of the MSTP stuff that we do, so I have.
Good.
I was just wondering also if they're funding, if surgeon scientists are successful getting funding.
You know, I don't know the statistics, probably somewhere one could dig through NIH and discover that. I would not be surprised to hear that success rates for surgeons who submit grants to NIH are somewhat lower than perhaps for other specialties, but I don't know that that means it's not a good model, because it's clearly been successful for some. It may mean that surgeons are not particularly in a good position because of training or time commitments to be as competitive as people in other specialties. But that shouldn't discourage you too much. I would say if you've got a great idea and if you've got the time commitments to pursue that, and if you're in an environment that's going to support the infrastructure that you need, NIH is going to look at that a lot more than what your particular specialty is. They're going to want to ask the question, is this somebody who knows what they're talking about? Is the research that they're proposing something that's exciting, that's groundbreaking, that's achievable, although perhaps a little bit risky? That's how it's going to get assessed. I don't think they'll look at your CV and go, oh, surgeon, and hold that against you. I will tell you a little anecdote. A student who came to NIH to be a HHMI scholar, so he's a medical student coming to NIH for a year to do research, came to my lab to work on progeria, this dramatic form of premature aging, because of his particular interest in plastic surgery. Stayed for a second year. That was going pretty well. Decided, wow, I think I want to get a PhD. Ultimately, we worked out with NYU, which is where he was enrolled as a medical student, to turn this into an MD-PhD. And he and I had a countless conversation about whether his dream of being a plastic surgeon was going to fit. He went and met with plastic surgeons who were doing research. He learned a bit more about it. Ultimately, he really did want the experience of being able to do some procedures, and concluded that for him, he could achieve that and have a better opportunity for protected time to do research if instead of plastic surgery, he did dermatology. And that's what he's now doing and seems pretty happy with it. So there may be ways to sort of think about modifying without, you know, giving up the dream, but maybe tweaking it in a certain way. And I don't mean to say that dermatology is somehow better than plastic surgery, only that in this kid's situation, that turned out to be a good compromise. So watch for those things.
Thank you.
All right. Ben, can you hear? You can go ahead.
Dr. Collins, thank you again for taking the time for this session. I'm a first-year MD-PhD student at Vanderbilt. And the motivation for this question is that I'm looking at physical sciences labs that generally have longer time to degrees than some of the other labs. And I'm curious as to your position on the length of physician scientist training, and I guess normal PhD training as well. I know the most recent report recommended shortening the training time for the PhD phase. But from talking to PIs, I've also gotten the advice that cutting training also compromises your professional development and your ability to do quality science. So how do you balance those two competing factors? And also, how do you kind of position yourself best for the next step and residency and junior faculty positions?
That's another great question, Ben, and you're in a great place at Vanderbilt to be posing that question to people around you. Well, my greatest concern is that we keep people in training positions too long, and that slows down the process of developing independence, where you can become more the master of your own research program and decide what you want to work on. I do not think that the PhD part of an MD-PhD program should go on beyond 4 years, and ideally it ought to be less than that. Because what you're really learning in that part of the program is an approach to research, a means of thinking rigorously about science, about how you decide what's an interesting question, how do you set up experiments to approach that, whether it's basic or translational or clinical, how do you make sure you think about the controls, how do you interpret data, how do you learn to write scientific papers. Frankly, I don't think it is nearly as crucial in that PhD portion that you develop a huge bibliography of papers that you have published, because you're going to go back into the clinical arena if you follow the usual pathway at the end of that and do a residency in something and then a fellowship in something, and then you will probably retrain and retool your research capabilities as part of your fellowship. And that is going to be the platform upon which you launch yourself into an academic career if academia is where you're going. So I think the goal ought to be to get through that research training as efficiently as possible and not linger on in the PhD part of an MD-PhD. And to sound a little cynical, I think sometimes the PIs that you're referring to may have a bit of a conflict of interest here in the sense that it's good for them to have, you know, these really talented MD-PhD students in the lab cranking out research and publishing papers, because that makes the whole lab look good, but it may not be in their own best interest to linger there too long. So if I were you, I'd push back a little bit on, wait a minute, okay, if this is good, who is it good for? And if we're all concerned, and I bet anybody who looks at the data would be, about the increasing age of individuals before they become independent researchers in U.S. biomedicine, why is it a good idea to have very long PhD segments in an MD-PhD program? That's part of the problem. We need to fix that.
Great answer. Thank you. Evan, do you want to go next?
Sure. So hi, Dr. Collins. Thank you again for joining us tonight. This is Evan Ock. I'm the current president of APSA, at least for another 7 days or so. And I'm also a PGY2 resident in neurology at Cornell in New York City. One question I had was regarding MD-PhD attrition in programs. I was wondering what you see as the greatest challenge to promoting physician-scientist training and how we can prevent attrition. There was a recent article in Academic Medicine, actually, to which Peter, myself, and the incoming president, Michael Gu, actually published a letter to the editor, which will be coming out momentarily, actually, regarding the ways to prevent attrition. Some of that focused on the difference between MSTP and MD-PhD, the difference in notoriety of certain institutions, and also some of these other factors we talked about, such as length of training, interest in subspecialties, and then the kind of funding gap between making a clinical salary and a basic science salary later on in your career. So I was wondering, number one, I guess what you see as the biggest challenge to keeping physician scientists in that path and how we at APSA can help you in that mission, if any at all.
What a great question, Evan, and thank you for your leadership of this organization, at least for the next few days. So this has got a lot of factors involved. Part of the issue, of course, is honest disclosure at the beginning about what this pathway involves and what has been the experience of others who have traveled it at your institution. I think every institution has a responsibility to let their prospective student trainees know what has been that institution's track record as far as successful completion of the training program and what has happened to people who have gone on beyond that, so you know what the experience has been. And almost no institution does that, and that's something I think we really need to push. For instance, I think a lot of people assume when they get into this kind of training pathway that the only likely outcome is that they're going to end up in a tenure track position in an academic institution, being a triple threat for research and teaching and patient care. And in fact, the statistics would say there's a lot of other pathways out there which are equally rewarding but don't get talked about very much and then get considered a sort of second-rate alternative careers, as we call them, a term that we should get rid of right now. And that is another area where I think NIH might be able to help, at least with training programs that we directly support and therefore have some influence over, which is honest disclosure. What are you getting into here? What is the likely outcome that you're headed for? Let's try to be more transparent about that so people don't get surprised or disappointed. Second, mentoring. Most of the people, I think, who go through these training programs hit bumps in the road. I could tell you my own stories of times where I was so ready to quit, and it had not been for the availability of a senior professor who would sit and listen to my sorrow about the failed experiment and the unexpected bumps in the road. I might very well be doing something very different now. But not everybody seems to have access to that. And I think we really, as an ecosystem that cares about trainees, need to do a better job of that. And let me say, in a particular way, I worry about those individuals who come from underrepresented backgrounds for whom the natural mentoring network that seems to be there for a lot of us may not be so natural. I am deeply concerned, you know, that our scientific workforce, and this certainly applies to MD-PhD, does not look like the population of this country. And we have got to figure out some way to make these kinds of careers more appealing, not to individuals from typically underrepresented backgrounds. And when they do decide to enroll, which many of them do, how do we keep those folks from being particularly vulnerable to attrition? And a lot of that is a sort of failed mentorship to help you over those rough spots that are inevitably going to happen. I got to mention women here, too, because I think we still, despite having made great gains in the enrollment of women in graduate programs and MD-PhD programs and postdocs and fellowships, we have still not dealt with the reality of the attrition that occurs along the way. And we don't see anything like the proportionality of women in leadership positions as chairmen of departments and deans that we should have by now. And that means we are not doing right by women who are coming through these particular training pathways to create the kind of flexibilities that ought to be there. So we got a lot of work to do to address this. And I don't know about what you wrote, Evan, in this piece that you mentioned, but I hope a lot of those issues were pointed to. We collectively as a community have a lot of work to do here.
Great, thanks so much. Yeah, well, I guess it'll be out soon, so I can take a look at it.
I will.
All right, so Michelle, do you want to go next? And before you ask the question, Michelle, I'll just say let's just go for about 7-8 more minutes.
Sure, that's me.
Okay, go ahead.
So I'm coming from Sean Morrison's lab at University of Michigan, and I just want to say go blue.
Go blue.
And I recently met with the director of our program, Wayne Yokoyama, and we were talking about the role of APSA in advocacy for the physician scientist training path. And I'd like to know your opinion on what should be the role of APSA.
Well, what a great question. I absolutely think the role should be as big as you can possibly make it, especially after this recent Ginsberg report showing just how much stress physician scientist trainees seem to be under and how a lot of that is as a consequence of the scaling back of resources that have gone into medical research and into training. I don't know what APSA's visibility is right now in places like Capitol Hill or whether you have a regular plan amongst your members to be communicating with your elected officials to let them know about your passion for what you're doing and your concern about whether that is now under threat and potentially being put at risk by the lack of the ability of the government to be able to come up with a stable trajectory for what you want to do. But I must tell you, the times I have been on the Hill advocating for medical research, which is oftentimes 2 or 3 times a week, the times that have gone the best is when I bring along somebody with me who is in training, who's excited about the science that they're trying to do, but also deeply concerned about whether they're going to be able to continue to do it. Your voices are among the most effective out there, and I hope you are using every possible means to express yourselves by letter, by turning up on Capitol Hill, by whatever APSA has as far as a formal voice that you can share. The future is in your hands, and the people who are making those decisions need to hear from you.
I understand that, but I would like your advice on how to more formally affect that role. So how do you suggest that we take on that role at Capitol Hill in policy?
Well, I should ask Peter and Evan sort of what is APSA's formal mechanism for doing that, because I don't know.
So APSA has a APSA has a formal policy committee that has been very active in creating surveys, studies, examining many of the factors we talked about tonight. But in addition to that, Jennifer Kwan, who's our policy chair and has been the chair for quite some time, and I think has obviously invited you last year to our policy panel, has been very active in Capitol Hill lobbying this year with the ACTS meeting, along with Barry Kohler, really trying to work on some of the initiatives that organization is working on. So, you know, Jennifer is very active. The organization in general is very active and open to ideas about how we can help to improve MD-PhD and physician scientist training in general.
So one of the things, and I don't want to spend too much time on this because it gets into the weeds, but to know who are the critical figures in both houses who control the appropriations process, who are the members on those subcommittees and full committees that are going to vote about the NIH budget, focus your effort on those people. And they oftentimes come from parts of the country that don't have Harvard or MIT in their district, but they're critical decision makers. And it's too easy for those members to assume that their vote against medical research doesn't really affect their constituency because they haven't heard from anybody in their state. I hope APSA has a good sense of who those most critical targets are and focus your attention that way. It's one thing to have everybody write to their congressman. Frankly, most of you are probably writing to Congress people who are already convinced that NIH is a good thing. It's the critical ones who haven't been able to believe that that you really need to focus on. And maybe Jennifer's already doing that, but I just wanted to mention it.
Okay, thank you. So just a few more minutes. We have three more questions that people submitted, and I'm going to let Zach and then Danya and then Ada Obi, and then we can hopefully finish within about 5 minutes. So, Zach, okay. Do you want to go ahead?
Hi, yes. This is Zach. I'm actually the Northeast representative for the – I'm an undergraduate liaison for the Northeast region for APSA, and I just wanted to ask, earlier this April I was reading an article in which you mentioned to Anna Edney in Bloomberg News interview some very preliminary research findings regarding Alzheimer's disease project progress, and I was curious if you had a rough estimate of the appropriation of funding percentage-wise and what that looks like between clinical, basic, and translationally based research projects regarding Alzheimer's disease.
Well, Alzheimer's is clearly a major public health challenge right now, and the toll this is taking in terms of human terms and economic terms is truly devastating, and it is one of the areas that we're trying to prioritize in terms of ramping up the effort, especially because the science is looking very exciting. The rough breakdown between basic and clinical, it's about 50-50. I don't have the precise numbers, but it's in that space. This year, we're spending $566 million on Alzheimer's research, and that doesn't count a lot of basic neuroscience that may ultimately be connected to Alzheimer's, but we don't know it yet. And we also have a new program working jointly with industry called the Accelerating Medicines Partnerships, which is directly focused on Alzheimer's to try to be sure we're linking up clinical trials that they're doing and the ones that we're doing to test the same biomarkers. So it is a very high priority area, and you can get more information if you go to the NIH website about that.
Okay, thank you.
You know we're short on time, so I will shorten my comments a little more than I have been.
That's okay. Thank you.
All right, Danya, you want to go ahead? Hey, Danya, can you hear me? If not, Ada Obi, can you? Oh, we cannot hear you, Danya. You might be on mute. Sorry, she's writing in the chat box. Can you hear me? Okay, well, Yeah, her mic is not working. So let's just go on to Ada Obi, if that's okay.
Sure.
Last question. All right, well, he's not talking. So I'm just going to go ahead and ask his question. He wrote it in the chat box. So thank you, Dr. Collins, for taking this time to talk to us. I'm from a little different perspective. Oh. We can't hear. I'm just reading his question. He said hello in the chat box. Sorry. I completed my MD-PhD at Temple University. I just finished my residency and I'm starting fellowship this summer. I'm subsequently going back to Temple to help establish the new dermatology department. My question is the challenge I have had in trying to reestablish continuity with my PhD roots post-residency. What opportunities, sources, or tools are available to help MD-PhDs who are about to get into the workforce after 4 years of clinical training to get reconnected with research opportunities to help them guide the early career job decisions?
Well, that's another great question. And it is sort of one of the challenges that our focus on the MD-PhD training plan creates for everybody, where you have this intense experience during the MD-PhD doing perhaps 3 or 4 years of protected time to do research, and then you're back in the clinical arena perhaps for 3 years, maybe as many as 5 or 6 years doing residency and fellowship. I think for MD-PhDs who then expect to go on from that to an academic research position, you just want to try everything you can for that fellowship period to have very significant protected time for research with a mentor who is going to help you develop the research plan, which you will then use as your own launching pad for academic research. It sounds like the person asking the question may not have quite had that experience and may be feeling now a little bit rusty in terms of research experience after all that clinical training. There are ways to deal with that. NIH, of course, has lots of various awards that all start with the letter K that could be useful. I would certainly think it would be critical then to identify a mentor who has a vigorous research enterprise that could help you get your feet back under you again in terms of developing a vigorous research program, apply for an NIH K award, get that started. But then not really expect you're going to be able to suddenly become a fully fleshed out independent researcher until you've had a year or two to get your research chops back together again. That takes a little time, especially if you're ending up in a somewhat different field than where you were during your PhD training, which many people would be. So just don't shortchange the chance to have that research immersion to get you off the ground. You don't want to find yourself unprepared when you're the independent guy trying to manage other people in your own lab. So, Peter, it sounds like we may have come to the end of the questions and the end of the hour.
That's great. Thank you very much. If you guys want to unmute, you guys can just say thank you vocally if you'd like, but we appreciate
One other thing before they go ahead. I hope you all are watching all the great things that are happening across the area of biomedical research, not just in your own field. If I can give you two bits of advice. One is if it's your opportunity to be making a selection about a project, pick something important, not just sort of a derivative next step, because there's lots of that going on. Try to find a question that's really interesting and really matters and put your time on that, even if it's a little riskier. And secondly, and this sort of plays together, don't prematurely narrow your horizon into a small area of biomedical research that happens to be your current focus. Keep looking at what's going on in this amazing landscape of research opportunities. You never know when you're going to hit something that sets up a light bulb saying, oh, wow, I could apply that to what I'm doing. Or, you know, maybe that's the area I'd like to work in a couple of years. Keep your options wide open. There's no reason to get narrow at this point. And, finally, if you want to follow what's happening from the perspective of the NIH director, have a look at the blog that I write every Tuesday and every Thursday, and sign up to be one of my Twitter followers to join the 31,000 that are seeing what I say every day, and maybe you'll think it's ridiculous, but it will be something amusing. You can hear about the NIH bear that was on our campus over the last couple of days.
Great. Yes, you have a lot of followers on Twitter, Dr. Collins, and I'm one of them. So.
Oh, good.
Thank you very much for joining. We
Thank
appreciate
you so
your
much.
Time, sir.
Thank you.
It was fun. Thank you all.
Everyone have a good
all the
night.
Hard work you're doing. Keep it up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye, everybody.